From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. It's estimated that roughly 800,000 Rwandans were killed in that three-month period back in 1994. Kwasaliste Munson is the son of one of the victims. He is the subject of a new documentary, Life After Death, which premieres this week at the True False Film Festival. Now, the film tracks Kwasa's efforts to find stable work, despite being an infamous former thief in Kigali. Helping him are his best friend, Fies, and American philanthropists Suzette and Dave Munson. This oftentimes humorous portrait explores Kwasa's struggle to escape his past and to chart his own future. Today on Global Journalist, we'll talk with the film's director, Joe Callender, about what went into making the film. And Joe Callender joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome, Joe, to Global Journalist. Glad to have you.
Good to be here.
So in your words, let's talk about this film. What's it all about?
Well, I am a filmmaker in residence for Dave and Suzette. They own a retail company, Saddleback Leather. And so basically I just kind of follow them around sometimes and they tell me what they're doing and I tell them what might make a good story. And so that's kind of how this happened.
Yeah. And so when we meet Kwasa and his friend Fies, you know, the first 10 minutes or so of the film is really a very intimate look at their life. I mean, you have terrific access, and these two guys are characters, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a little unusual in that culture to find a guy like Kwasa. So when I did find such a charismatic character, I kind of latched onto him pretty immediately. And you know, he was a good guy to follow for this thing.
He's not bashful at all. He talks about his past, and he talks about the fact that he's a thief and that he's really good at stealing, or was at one point very good at stealing cell phones, for instance. And you know, he's kind of monkeying around with his friend. But you build an immediate bond in this film with Kwasa, and I've got to believe that was your intention.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's some funny bits in the beginning, and I think humor is just the most direct and quickest way to kind of develop a relationship and for the viewer to be invested in what they're seeing. So that's why I kind of put that stuff in early, because I wanted the viewer to immediately kind of get on Kwasa's side and be rooting for him.
And definitely you do get that sense. And so you go through and you kind of establish the fact that Kwasa is a character that's having a hard time getting his life on track. How old is he?
I think he's something like 22 or 23.
Right. So and this being the 20th anniversary of the genocide, we learn fairly early on in the movie that life was tough for Kwasa from the very beginning, and he lost his mother very tragically. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, his mother was fleeing the genocide, and in the film you hear a couple different versions of what happened. You know, Kwasa has a very tragic story that he tells, but Fies' mother, who was Kwasa's close friend, tells a different story of a different way that she died, which is a little, you know, you're not going to grade which is more tragic, but, you know, so I kind of left it open.
Right. Nonetheless, Suzette and Dave Munson are a couple of American philanthropists who are trying to help him out. They own Saddleback Leather in Texas. They have established a foundation called Love 41 to help them. We want to listen to a bit of a clip here explaining how Suzette feels upon visiting Kwasa.
I met Kwasa last time I was here, my husband Dave and I. I think a lot of people still doubt him because of who he was and the things he's done. He's got a lot of scars everywhere on his face and stuff. Last time I was here, he asked if I had any type of lotion to make the scars go away. And I said, no, not really. I said, there is some like oil that helps, but it will never take away your scars. And he was saying, well, I look bad because of them. And I said, no, actually, I think you're beautiful. have a friend who works and does this like every day, and she says she never gets used to it. And I guess I can see why she'd never get used to it. I don't know. But it kills me to think that once again tonight, this is where he's going to be sleeping. There's a lot of people like this, but until you sit here and you experience it yourself, and it just doesn't seem as real. That's all.
Suzette, they're sitting with Kuwasa in a ramshackle sort of room in Rwanda, and try to reach out to him. They did commission you to make this film. You know, a lot of people would ask, how much independent control did you have in terms of what went into this?
Honestly, it was pretty incredible. I don't know. Dave is a pretty radical guy, and he just puts a lot of emphasis on storytelling. And I basically had total creative and editorial control over everything. I mean, they just figured that I knew more about telling a story and making movies than they did, and they trusted me to do that.
You know, there are a lot of international films at this year's True False, and some of them, you know, along this line of sort of American, Christian Americans trying to help out in Africa. There are a couple of films on that theme, some of which don't necessarily portray that effort as being the best. What was the goal here? Was that part of the goal, was to sort of look at this sort of American Christian nonprofit and how it was trying to do work in Rwanda?
I don't think for me I had that kind of perspective. I mean, I just know Dave and Suzette so well. To me, it was more a story of them, and they may be picked as representative of a bigger thing, but to me, it was just telling their story and what they do on the ground over there.
You very much get the sense, though, that for all the good that someone, you know, across the seas might try to offer to help, that there are many obstacles that get in the way of, even if that help gets to the people that that it's intended to help, that's hardly the end of the story.
I mean, it's tough, man, and I've been over there 4 times, and these problems are just very, very complex. You know, they need, first of all, safety, and then, you know, some sustainable infrastructure, which Dave has designs on moving toward. I won't say too much about that without asking him first.
Sure. Probably a good idea. Okay, so Kuwasa, you know, in the making of a documentary film, I'm always amazed. You know, I worked in television. We worked on 2-minute stories, not on, you know, an hour plus stories. I'm always fascinated about the building of characters and sort of an underlying feeling that we get without you ever saying a word. And I felt that way about Kuwasa, both in my affinity toward him, but also in the understanding of this sort of separation. And so, was that a theme you were trying to establish? I mean, what are you trying? Are you trying to invoke something, or are you just letting the story sort of take a viewer where it takes them?
I don't know. I mean, I wanted the characters to be natural, and that kind of presented its own challenges in a way, because I wanted Feast and Kwasa especially to just be natural, and I wanted that natural friendship interaction between the two of them. And the main problem there is I don't speak their language, so for most of those scenes, like, I had no idea what anybody was saying. But I think it was worth the risk because, you know, otherwise it would have just been kind of stilted and impossible, really, to get any kind of natural interaction between the two of them.
The trailer for this shows the two, Feast and Kwasa, getting ready to have a chicken dinner. But, of course, unlike here in the States where we would go to the supermarket, they actually have the chicken there. And there's some pretty stark symbolism that goes in that about just how real that is. That's an interesting choice for the trailer. Is there something therein that you wanted to convey?
Not really. I after I put it together, I mean, I just really like that scene. And I think it kind of sets the tone for just the gravity of the situation over there, because, you know, they kill the chicken themselves. And I just also think it's a nice interaction between Kwasa and Feast, and you see kind of immediately how savvy and charismatic Kwasa is.
Yeah. Humor, despite the tragic nature of this entire sort of backgrounding story, humor continues to play a role. Here's another example of how you worked that into Life After Death.
Hey there, this is Suzette.
And I'm Tina.
And we're from Love 41. And we want to talk to you today about our two upcoming fundraisers for 2014.
Our first fundraiser is our daycare. Our dream daycare is the one we started in Rwanda about a year ago, and we need funds for this dream daycare so it can continue.
We need to redo this because there's too many. Do. Hey everybody, this is Suzette. Yeah.
We are raising funds for our daycare.
Okay, ready?
Daycare.
Are you ready? Okay. It's going to be a while, Joe. It's going to be a while.
I'm not a public speaker.
There's no public. It's just Joe.
Okay, go again.
Okay.
You know, I try to teach those same things here at the journalism school, and sometimes it resonates just about as well. That's kind of a good look at how imperfect the world of fundraising can be. What else is it?
Well, absolutely. And you know, if everything's going right, like, that's not interesting and it's not funny and it's not relatable. So, you know, I use that clip to, A, convey a lot of information that I wanted to convey, but also, B, do it in a funny way. And C, make these characters more relatable, because, you know, if you're laughing at them, you're like, oh, I mean, I've been in that same situation where I had to do something, I kind of screwed it up. And, you know, I mean, I think it's just a nice way to humanize people and make them relatable.
Before we continue our discussion, I do want to remind you that you can watch or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. There you can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to the program. This week we have several different elements about the True-False Festival now screening in Columbia, Missouri. Please send us your questions and comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. You can also visit our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter. That address is @globaljourn. So you've been to True False. Let's talk a little bit about True False and why you decided that this was a good venue to be the first place to see this film.
Well, last year I was there with a film called Tina Delivers a Goat, and they were the first place. They kind of picked that out of the. They just picked that out, and you know, they kind of gave me a hand up when I was just getting started. And if I can, you know, repay the kindness with premiering at True False, then I'm more than happy to do that.
And you're a New Yorker out in L.A. right now. But you may have a bone to pick with them, not to pick up on the chicken theme from earlier, but they labeled this film as satire, and you take issue with that?
Well, I don't like that word. I think I've opened myself up to it just because, you know, there's a lot of humor in the film. And I just haven't seen anything quite like this before. I mean, I think it'll level out in the next film or two that I do. But I just see this as a more of an existential film. And the main reason I don't like the word satire is there's a risk of condescension there, you know, and I just love all these characters in my film so much. And, you know, I treat them with humor, but it's all from love.
How do you establish the kind of access and closeness? You know, I think I read somewhere in our notes that you spend a total of about, 10 weeks there off and on with these two young men. How do you get so close so quickly, and how do you allow others to just really get into their soul and their minds?
Well, I think, you know, when you're making a film, the filmmaker and the subjects feel kind of a collaboration, and they feel like they're building something. And a lot of the times, you know, I'm a one-man crew, so it was me, a translator, and Feast and Kwasa out there, you know, in the streets, sunburned, hungry, hot, sweaty, and, you know, just trying to do something. So I think a bond forms there when you're doing something like that.
And sometimes in a world so big, it just comes down to being that small, doesn't it?
That's pretty much it, man.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your origins of getting into filmmaking, because that's been an interesting path all its own. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always used to mess around with the camera when I was a kid, and then I kind of dropped it and went and got an advertising degree. And then I was working a marketing job. I was 25, and I was like, you know what, I don't want to do this. Never mind for the rest of my life. I don't want to do it another 2 weeks.
So you quit.
I flew to Bangkok. I knew a Vietnam veteran there who used to be a crackhead, but now he's getting a PhD degree. So I thought that was an interesting place to cut my teeth on how to learn how to make a film.
And what did you learn there?
Oh, boy, I don't think we have enough time to go into it.
Nonetheless, you've had success with other films as well. Talk about a couple of those and the fact that, you've been to Sundance, for one, right?
Sure. Yeah. Tim and Susan Have Matching Handguns is a 95-second short film that played at Sundance this past January, and that'll also be playing at True Falls.
What can you tell in 95 seconds that gets you to Sundance?
Well, I followed a similar formula to Tina Delivers a Goat, which was 2 minutes long. So, you know, I apparently have these tiny little microfilms cornered. But basically, it was just this really kind of a nice little story. Tim and Susan are Kwasa's sponsors, and they also have an appearance in the feature. But this was a nice little scene that I really liked that didn't fit in the feature, so I cut it as its own short film and sent it to Sundance, and they liked it.
That's kind of crazy good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you just put so much effort into these other projects, and then it took me, you know, a day and a half to make that, and that's what ends up getting into Sundance.
Go figure, right? Yeah. So obviously, sometimes you probably feel as lucky as you do good, but what do you hope that folks get out of watching your films? Is it different for each film?
I don't know. You know, there was a press conference Bob Dylan did, his last full televised press conference in San Francisco in the mid-60s, and somebody asked him, what do you want people to get out of yours? What are you trying to say with your songs? And he says, every song I write trails off with, good luck, I hope you make it. And the journalist was like, that's not anywhere in any of your songs. He's like, yes, it's in every single one. So...
So maybe that's not the point. Is this more about... self-expression and something that's inside of you that's wanting to get out, or is it more about the end user and what you're trying to convey? Sounds like,
well,
it's the first.
I mean, with this film, it's like, you know, like I said, it's like an existential film. I mean, some people are born into hell and some people are born into opportunity. I mean, Dave and Suzette grew up, you know, they weren't wealthy. They're self-made, and it's just the system we were born into. And kind of what I wanted to say with this film is, like, you know, some people are born into this, some people are born into that, but the best you can do is kind of try to be nice to each other and you know, just be kind.
Clearly, in a place like Rwanda, nothing could be further than the case. And I do find it very interesting that I felt like with watching Feast and Kwasa that these are kids that you could find, you know, worth that they spoke English on any street in America. You got them doing some Taekwondo and some very humorous moves in there. You know, whether you intend to or not, the world closes into very small places. And we see a lot of similarities in one another, don't we, when we see films like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, usually out of Africa, it's either like some nature film or some tragedy film or something. But I mean, you know, they're just like us. They just want to fall in love and have dinner with their friends and, you know, try to work a job and live a stable life.
You know, he doesn't seem like he's ever going to get there. He's got just sort of a rebel without a clue. It's not that he doesn't have opportunity in this film. He has opportunity presented to him over and over again. Yes?
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah.
What do you think it is that prevents him from finding, because it seems like it's right there for him to grasp.
You know, I think from a Western point of view, it's so frustrating to watch him, but you got to understand that he didn't grow up with that mentality of an honest culture and, you know, work hard and get ahead. I mean, he's been in survival mode his whole life. And I think in the film, that's what we see. It's just him in survival mode. And part of that is just hustling, you know, maybe not working, maybe just trying to get what he can get from who he can get it from, you know?
Yeah. We've got another clip that we'd like to listen to right now.
No more bad photos on your phone.
Yes, ma'am.
He had a, there was a, supposedly it's not his photo. It's
me,
not your photo.
Me, I'm very sure. My phone, I don't like photo bad. I like Christian music.
Okay. No sex.
No.
Photos. Nibio? Okay, no.
Mama,
it's not,
you can't,
it's not good for your mind.
Yeah. Me, like, you know, I put here, mm-hmm. So I take Christian music. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, yeah. My brother Tanazi, he like, very. So.
Me?
Eh.
I don't think that was Atanas's photo.
To the point of hustling, you almost get the sense that Kwasa's always playing the angle. Like,
yeah.
Right?
I think that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Has he seen the film? And if so, what was his takeaway?
He saw a big chunk of it because I didn't have the final cut when I left, obviously, but I had about a 50-minute cut and I gave that to him on a DVD. He had actually asked for it because he wanted to go around to the prisons in Kigali and show the wardens to prove that he was, you know, a good person and a changed man.
and somehow he thought that if he were on the big screen, that argument would be made easier?
Apparently that's the connection he made, yeah.
And what about Feast? I mean, Feast doesn't play as big a role. You said that many Rwandans of his age group are very subdued. And Feast certainly, he seems like, you know, if they were the Caped Crusader and his sidekick, Feast is the sidekick, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I really like Feast. He's a very intelligent, quiet guy. And a lot during the production, he would always come over and try to help me, you know, carry gear. And he was always very aware of opportunities for him to help. So I don't know. I hope he's okay. I hope he makes it out all right.
You didn't get into some of the more serious and historic issues. Why didn't you get into more of the 20 years, you know, since Hutu versus Tutsi violence and that kind of thing in this film?
You know, it just wasn't my tragedy and I don't feel qualified to talk about it. And I just didn't want it to be, it's just so easy to go over there and try to make a film like that. And if I did that, it probably would have just been a terrible embarrassment to me. So I just wanted to go over and just try to tell a human story about people that are not that different than us.
Yeah, there's a little question that this is a way to maybe bring that back to the forefront in a non-preachy way. And, you know, I don't know you, but I'm guessing that preaching is probably not where you're coming from.
Yeah, I'm not a preacher and I'm not a politician, just a storyteller.
Yeah. Well, it's a good story. If, you know, in looking at the body of your work, are there resonating themes? Are there things that the people have told you, hey, I keep getting this out of your stuff? Or is the beauty of the art that you get something different every time you open up a different box?
I think people are starting to sense a pattern. I mean, definitely the humor is there, and that's something that will always be there. I mean, I'm just very interested in trying to make films and tell a story in film the same way. You know, I'll tell a story to my friend if we're having a beer, and you know, usually they're funny stories. So,
your personal story, you know, back to that for a second. You talk about lots of destitution, desperation, psychological fissures, and crying, in terms of making the transition into being a documentarian. Life sure looks a lot better now, but it's hard work doing what you do, isn't it?
Man, it's real hard. And you know, I didn't go to film school. I didn't have any connections. I don't know. Like I said, it was just a compulsion. It was something I had to do, and I never had a plan B, which is good because I don't think plan A would have worked. So, it, I mean, it's really only been like 6 years, which I guess isn't that bad to get a feature through the door, but it feels a lot longer than that.
I think being a true false a couple of times itself is a pretty good feature in that period of time. What are you working on now?
Like I said, I'm a filmmaker in residence for this company, Saddleback, so I'm doing just a bunch of marketing stuff for them, and that's about it.
Yeah, and is that kind of the thing that pays the bills out? You know, if you go to Saddleback's website, there are some, to say that they're interesting marketing strategies might be an understatement. They certainly grab your attention.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on salary there, so I, any video you see on the site is probably my doing.
And can you characterize those at least in these videos, intended to show that they can handle just about anything life can throw at you? There are a couple where I guess it is Dave that's showing them off with African tribes dancing in the background.
Right. Yeah. He just wants everything on the site to be short films. That's kind of his vision. So that's what he hired me for. And it's just been kind of a radical experiment in marketing.
Do you have a big project on the horizon that you're hoping to achieve either in the short or long term?
I think there's another story with Dave. He's got another kind of plan that's even crazier than this one. I mean, it starts with taking one of their sponsored children from Rwanda and flying them to Mexico to learn Spanish, but I can't give away any more than that.
All right, terrific. Well, we really appreciate you taking some time to join us on Global Journalist, and we do want to let the audience know, the show times tonight, Thursday night, at the Big Ragtag at 10:30 p.m., then Saturday at the Globe, that'll be at 6 o'clock, and then Sunday, the movie will be shown, or the documentary will be shown at the Blue Note, starting at 5:15. It's called Life After Death. Joe Callender has been our guest today. And Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. I was joined today by Joe Callender, who directed the film Life After Death. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer, and Olga Kristalova is this week's lead producer. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink.